are a lot of stories in the news these days about GMOs, genetically modified organisms, including insect-resistant cotton, herbicide-resistant corn, and rice that has been modified to contain more vitamin B. And they remain a subject of intense controversy, from whether we should label foods containing GMOs to whether they should be banned altogether. What is your take? Your questions, your concerns, or does this even matter to you? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are going to be talking with a guest journalist who has researched the topic extensively and has concluded that while numerous valid questions remain, GMOs will neither destroy nor save the world. And he says the stakes in this debate are low. We are guessing there might be some debate over that, or at least some questions for him at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Nathaniel Johnson is a journalist, a food writer for Grist, and a teacher at the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. He is the author of a recent series of articles about GMOs for Grist, including What I Learned from 6 Months of GMO Research, None of It Matters. Good morning.
Morning. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for getting up early to join us. None of it matters. Why do you say that?
Well, I have to admit to a little bit of journalistic sensationalism in that headline.
Okay.
You know, of course, since I've written that, I've heard from a lot of people who have been involved in this struggle for their entire lives, to whom it matters quite a bit. But I do think that it's justified in that a lot of the time when we talk about genetically modified food, it is a debate of extremes. It's really about, is this going to save the world or is it going to imperil the world? And I really was surprised that the stakes are quite a bit lower than that. I really wasn't convinced that genetically modified food is necessary to save the world, and nor was I convinced that it's really a huge risk. That there's much bigger risks that we run all the time than this technology poses.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about those risks or those perceived risks. Why would someone be against using genetically modified organisms?
Well, there's lots of different reasons, and they all sort of play into each other. I mean, I think this is one of the reasons why it's so difficult to talk about, that you can be opposed to genetically modified organisms for health reasons, or there's, you know, fears about corporate control, or fears about the way that it's dominated the patent system, and these kind of all group together and are hard to pick apart. But if you're talking about health, which is what people tend to talk about when they talk about risks, basically, there is a slightly higher risk of unintended consequences when breeders are using genetic engineering to work on plants than when they're using conventional breeding, and so that does pose the risk that something untoward perhaps could happen. We don't have any evidence of that happening so far. And they've been around for quite a time, a long time. So,
well, yeah, I just there was a big splash with I don't know, I think it was Cheerios or a cereal brand saying no more GMOs in breakfast cereals made by this manufacturer. So, how big a deal is that?
Well, it's just the original Cheerios. It's not all of the breakfast cereals. It's not even all the different types of Cheerios. So in that sense, it's a little bit of a smaller deal. But I do think that it represents a bit of a tipping point. You know, we're at an interesting time right now in this conversation about genetically modified food, because we've got all these states that have laws moving through the legislatures to label genetically modified food. And so this announcement by General Mills that they're going to label Cheerios as non-genetically modified, it's the first time that a really big manufacturer has stepped up and said, we're going to change the labeling of our food based on whether it has genetically modified ingredients or not. And such an iconic food, too. You know, this is something, this is a brand that everybody knows.
Yeah, it is. And I'm wondering, is this just because they want to appease the growing public awareness, or is this an admission that whatever genetically modified organism was in Cheerios was hurting people?
Well, we have what General Mills says, and they made it very explicit that they were doing this not because they thought there was anything wrong with genetically modified food. They took pains to stress that they didn't think there's anything risky about genetically modified ingredients. They were going to continue supporting and using genetically modified ingredients in other foods. But they said, we're doing this because there's a chance that people will embrace it. And I read that to mean there's a chance that this could actually improve our sales.
Increase sales, yeah.
Yeah. And so I think what they're doing is an experiment. They see the writing on the wall that that labeling is going to happen in some form, somewhere. And they want to see what that means for, you know, do people pay more? Are they going to buy less of things that are genetically modified and more of things that are labeled? All these things are really important for a big company like General Mills to know in order to make decisions about its business practices.
What is, though, the health concern of GMO opponents, critics? What is feared is going to happen to us if we're eating GMOs in our Cheerios?
Well, there's all sorts of specific things that you hear, but basically, I mean, the people that are really smart about it, the people there are some scientists who do have concerns about genetically modified food. And when you talk to those people, they say, look, you know, there's nothing that we know is actually happening, but it's the unknown unknowns, as Rumsfeld would have put it. It's the things that we don't know to be worried about that we're worried about. So, so they're concerned that perhaps a piece of DNA gets misplaced and creates perhaps a toxin that we didn't have before, or an allergen. I think that's the source of the fears about health.
Yeah, are there other less scientifically based concerns?
Yes, there's. I mean, there's. If you only need to put the words GMO, those letters, into Google, and you'll be flooded with a lot of very non-scientific concerns about genetically modified organisms, and they range the gamut from things that, you know, that they're going to cause cancer to that they're going to poison us all slowly.
Yeah. Well, what about the arguments on the other side? What are the supporters saying about GMOs?
Well, the basic argument goes something like this. We're getting kind of low on food back in the 50s, and people were worried that we were going to have a population bomb and run out. And then Norman Borlaug and the Green Revolution saved us, and we had this enormous increase in yields, and we were able to do it. The problem is that we're starting to approach those limits again, and this time we're going to need something new to have those big increases in yields, and genetic modification is it. So that's, and, you know, I think there's lots of corollaries. There's lots of shiny visions for the future about, you know, different technologies that GMOs could represent. But that's sort of the basic idea, that we have these problems and genetically modified food is going to solve them.
Yeah. So are we using less chemicals on our crops because the genetically modified crops are more resistant to pests or disease?
Well, this gets into the point where we should start to talk about specific genetically modified organisms rather than GMOs as a whole. One of the things that I found really interesting is that we tend to talk about it as a GMOs are a monolithic entity, but they're all different plants and a few animals included in that entity, and they do all sorts of different things. So if you look at insect-resistant genetically modified organisms, these are usually things that have a bacteria-formed pesticide in them that prevents insects from eating the corn or the soybeans. Those really have decreased insecticide applications on farms. When you look more generally, it gets much more complicated.
Yeah, like what?
So the other major category used in commercial agriculture of genetically modified foods is herbicide-tolerant organisms. And these are plants that you can spray with Roundup, glyphosate, and they don't die. And this has led to a big increase in the use of glyphosate. At the same time, other herbicides has gone down. Glyphosate is a comparatively non-toxic herbicide, so it's arguable that's actually been a good thing that there's been this big replacement. But we have seen a big increase in the amount of herbicides that have been sprayed, and a bigger increase than we've seen in the amount of the decrease in insecticide.
So we have herbicide-resistant corn because the farmer wants to kill the weeds under the corn. I don't even understand why we want to spray Roundup on our corn.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So usually farmers use this herbicide, but they use it before the corn comes up or before the soybeans come up, and they'll use it at the end of the season to burn down, to wipe everything out. If they get weeds coming up in the middle of the growing season, there's really not much they can do with a general herbicide application if it's a broad-spectrum herbicide like glyphosate, because it will kill their crop. Now, with the herbicide-resistant plants, they're able to spray and knock down the weeds, but not kill the plants.
I get it. So we have, what is it, a wash? We have insect-resistant cotton, which you could consider a good thing, and herbicide-resistant corn, which maybe you're not so sure that's a good thing.
Right. I don't know if it's a wash. You know, if these things balance each other out, that's a very complicated equation that I'm not really qualified to do. But yeah, I'm not so sure about herbicide tolerance. I think that overall insect-resistant crops have been a win for the environment. And now we are seeing resistant insects developing. So that's an issue. But there are, you know, there are places where they've actually managed that really well. And even though they're developing the resistance, there's ways to fight back on that. And even if this is just a temporary thing, and the insect resistance will phase completely out the insect resistant crops, it'll still have represented a major increase in really poisonous, major decrease in really poisonous broad spectrum insecticides that were hurting the environment.
I wanted to go into those specific examples because it's not just, you mentioned the GMO is not this monolithic thing, it's different things.
Right.
And another example is that we have rice that has been modified to contain more vitamin B. That sounds like a good thing.
Right, more vitamin. Normally when people talk about it, they talk about the golden rice, which is modified to contain more vitamin A. Oh. Which, yes, there are places in the world where there's a lot of people with severe vitamin A deficiencies, and it leads to these horrible deformities, blindness, and death in children. And so the idea is that if you put vitamin A into the most basic foodstuff, into rice, that it would get to the most poor and desperate people no matter what, and it would solve this problem. We haven't gotten there yet. There's some major hurdles still. They haven't gotten the rice quite to where it needs to be. And we don't know if people actually eat it. You know, once this yellow rice is introduced, if people will be worried about it and reject it. But this is a sort of thing that has the potential to really be a game changer for combating poverty in Southeast Asia.
We are talking with Nathaniel Johnson. He's a journalist, a food writer for Grist. He's a teacher at the University of California, Berkeley, Graduate School of Journalism. He was the author of a recent series of articles about GMOs for Grist, genetically modified organisms. And we're talking about the GMO debate, the pros, the cons, the concerns, the issues in the news, including GMO labeling on foods. What do you think? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. After extensive research, Nathaniel says that he's learned that the stakes are really low in this debate, that while some valid questions remain, GMOs are not going to destroy the world, and they're not going to save the world either. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Hey, it's us, Click and Clack from Car Talk. How'd you like to turn your old car into something really great?
I'd be happy just to turn it into a car.
Yeah, but this is even better. Now you can turn your old car into your favorite radio shows.
Oh.
Like Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
Just donate it to this station.
Call 1-866-789-8627 or go to WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from Wasco Windows, a Wisconsin-based manufacturer of doors and windows using Rehau Ganeo profiles from Germany for passive and low-energy houses. Wasco is online at wascowindows.com.
Wisconsin Public Radio's audio archive is an endless stream of knowledge and entertainment. Find what you're looking for or discover something new. Start listening now at WPR.org.
Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up this afternoon between 3 and 6, it's Central Time. After 5, Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickert will discuss how reality television shows may actually be preventing teen pregnancies. They'll catch up on the news of the day and explore Wisconsin's claim to be the home of the largest six-pack of beer in the world. That's coming up today after 5 on Central Time. The This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Nathaniel Johnson. He is the author of a recent series of articles about GMOs for Grist, including What I Learned from 6 Months of GMO Research, None of It Matters. And we're welcoming your questions for him. We have many callers, so let's go to the phones. Linda in Door County. Hello, Linda.
Good morning, and thank you for having this debate. I have to disagree with Nathaniel. I feel that ever since the Plant Variety Protection Act of 1980 was put in place through an act of Congress, that it gave corporations the idea of control and greed, and this is how the GMOs came to be. If GMOs were just regular seeds and they were trying to sell them without all the extra licensing and the protections and the patent rights, I guess maybe the debate wouldn't be as strong on my end. But the matter of drift, that you can't control the bees and the butterflies and such, I live in a very, very organic area of Door County, and there's a huge threat all around with the GMO corn, and now with the GMO alfalfa. And also with the fact that there are Terminator seeds in the pipeline. I don't know if anyone's read that Brazil is considering this through their government. And being a seed collector myself, I feel very threatened. I'm at the low end, which is tomatoes and such. So they're not really after me just yet. But I only buy seeds from catalogs that have a safe seed pledge and who really care, because I like to collect my seeds. I like the idea that my seeds are 30 and 40 years old and maybe even much longer than that from somebody else's care. And if all of a sudden I'm growing, say, you know, a big field of tomatoes and I have more than 1% of the genetics of a Monsanto tomato in the genetics of my tomatoes, I all of a sudden have crossed their line on my property with their pollution. And I would have to pay licensing fees or get sued.
Yeah.
And I just don't find this to be a good way for America to go beyond the health fact.
I'm glad you brought up this aspect of the debate also in the news this week. But Nathaniel, can you explain this whole drift issue for us?
Yeah. There's a lot of issues in this question. The Plant Protection Act was brought about because there were people like, you know, the seed breeder Luther Burbank, who were really worried about, they were upset by the fact that they'd spend years and years developing a plant variety, and then as soon as they released it, they could never actually get a patent or make any money off of it. So this, I mean, and this predated genetically modified foods, the debate over this. And it's not just genetically modified seeds, of course, that are patented. However, it is the case that the big seed, genetically modified seed companies, which at this point are the seed companies, I mean, there's been a lot of consolidation in the industry. The GMO companies, specifically Monsanto, has been really aggressive about enforcing its patents and suing farmers that are planting GMO seeds. Now, the cases that I've seen, and I haven't read every single docket of every single lawsuit, but the cases that I have, in those cases, the farmers have been planting 95% to 98% GMO seed. You know, this is more than what happened if you simply were seeing a little bit of pollination, cross-pollination from GMOs here and there. So I think that the companies are, you know, they're being very aggressive and pretty belligerent about enforcing their patents. But I haven't seen any cases in which people are getting sued simply for a chance pollination of 1 or 2%.
Yeah. Is that chance pollination, aside from whether you're going to get sued or not, is that, is that hurting the organic food supply, that the tomatoes that our caller was growing?
I'm not sure about tomatoes. There are a few GMO tomatoes, but it's I'm not sure that they're very infrequently grown. I mean, we're really talking about corn and soybeans and some sugar beets when we're talking about genetically modified crops.
Right. And, of course, and I'm sorry, I was unclear. I meant she said she was growing tomatoes and she's afraid she's going to get, you know, maybe she could get sued and that's or whatever. But so, I mean, if there's a genetically modified corn crop nearby,
yes.
That's
yeah.
Right.
So if you're growing organic sweet corn and there's genetically modified corn across the road, there's a good chance that some of your kernels of corn are going to get pollinated by windblown GMO pollen, and you'll have some mixing there if they're planted right around the same time, because the corn has a very small window for pollination. So absolutely, that's a concern, and it's a real concern for organic farmers who want to make sure that by law, organic food isn't supposed to contain genetically modified ingredients.
Yeah, and is there some chance that these heirloom seeds would go away because of the push for genetically modified organisms?
I don't see that happening. There is a strong support for heirloom seeds. There is a lot of people who are interested in it, in maintaining those strains. However, there is, and it's happening. We're going to see these genes spread into the various different seed supplies, and that's simply a fact of life. Once you have plants growing, pollen spreads, and genes spread along with it.
Yeah, well, gosh, this sounds like the stakes are really high, Nathaniel.
Well, it depends on how you look at it. When I came to this research project, I saw the stakes being really high in this regard as well. But, pollen has always spread, and genetics have always mingled, and it's given us this wondrous diversity. I'm much less concerned after having done the research about, having some of these genes in our seed stock than when I started out.
Yeah, let's take a call from Pam in Milwaukee. Hello, Pam.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
First of all, I just have to say, shame on Grist. Now, you're not even getting to the crux of the matter here. The reason that some of these seed varieties, hybrid varieties, non-GMO or GMO require these kinds of modifications in regard to nutritional additions or in regard to pesticide resistance is because they're inferior forms of plants to begin with. And the heirloom varieties are the things that were superseded. Those are the varieties that are pest resistant, that don't require this type of, that have all the nutrients in them. You haven't even gotten into the crux of the matter. You can't explore a GMO subject like this without getting into the food system and a whole lot of other areas.
Well,
and I
Pam,
really wonder what your background is.
Pam, thank you. I mean, we'll give you a follow-up, but we're in a conversation. We haven't gotten to everything yet. What about that, Nathaniel?
I barely know how to respond. I mean, they're absolutely not inferior plants. The people that work on these aren't stupid. They wouldn't start with inferior plants and try to improve them. They start with the best they can get and try and build them up from there.
Yeah, and we said that you are a journalist and that you have been researching this issue for the last 6 months. Why did you decide to get involved in this very heated debate?
Well, it started out almost as kind of a little stunt. My editor turned me onto it, and I had no idea what I was getting into. You know, calls like that last one have become kind of the norm for me because it people are so passionate about this, and I had no idea. This is, you know, it's an uglier debate than anything I've ever experienced as a journalist. But what we wanted to do was say, look, this debate's been going on for 30 years now. There's been a lot of science done. What happens if just a reasonable, skeptical person methodically goes through and looks at all of the science and talks to all of the experts on both sides? Can a reasonable person come to a conclusion on genetically modified foods? And so that was the ambition of the project.
Yeah, and the conclusion of the project was?
Well, it's tremendously complex, but like I said in my final piece, I think it matters much less than the debate would lead us to believe. You know, this is it. It really seems like something that all sorts of different groups really want to make their primary focus, and I just don't see a good reason for that. You know, whether you're looking at it from a public health perspective, an environmental perspective, a world poverty perspective, there are other issues I think that are much more important and will bring much more leverage to those things than genetically modified foods.
And our caller dropped off, or I might have gone back to her. Why do you suppose this is an issue that people are so passionate about?
Well, I think that genetically modified foods have become a cultural touchstone. They're something that symbolize these much bigger issues. They symbolize the fact that we've really become alienated from our food system, and it feels tremendously uncomfortable to have put big corporations in charge of our food supply and not really know what we're eating. And so instead of addressing that issue directly, we use genetically modified foods as a metaphor to talk about it indirectly.
Yeah. Kevin emails, what about the very real possibility that the modified plants are the cause of bee colony collapse? This threatens billions of dollars worth of crops due to a lack of pollination. Is there evidence that GMOs are the cause of bee colony collapse?
I haven't seen any evidence on that. There's the possibility, you know, that there might be some isolated incidents where certain plants, the pollen of certain plants, is killing bees. The thing is that there's, you know, this is one of those issues where if you look at the sum of all the evidence out there, there are a lot of other things that are a lot more likely to be the cause. You know, the fact that we're putting so much more stress on bees with modern agriculture than we have before by moving them all around and really working them harder. The fact that we've seen these explosions in varroa mites, the fact that we're using neonicotinoid pesticides that sometimes get into the nectar that bees can sip. You know, all of these things are seem like much more likely hypotheses than genetically modified plants.
What is your take on GMOs, genetically modified organisms, GMO foods or crops? Do you try to avoid them? Do you have any specific concerns about different ones? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We are talking about the GMO debate with Nathaniel Johnson, who is a journalist and a food writer for Grist and the author of a recent series of articles about GMOs. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from our sustaining members. When you set up an ongoing monthly gift, your generosity benefits everyone who listens to WPR. If you're not currently a sustainer, become one today. Go to WPR.org and click donate.
Support also comes from United Way of Dane County through funding from CUNA Mutual Group, dedicated to ending homelessness for over 1,000 children who slept in local shelters last year and for their families. Information on getting involved at UnitedWayDaneCounty.org.
Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after 9 o'clock, it's On Point. After uprising, ousters, a military takeover, and a vote on a new constitution, On Point will take a look at the dreams and hard realities in Egypt right now. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. We are talking about the GMO debate with our guest, Nathaniel Johnson, who is a teacher at the University of California, Berkeley, Graduate School of Journalism. He is a journalist, a food writer for Grist, and we're talking with him about his recent series of articles about GMOs for Grist, including what I learned from 6 months of GMO research. None of it matters. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you'd like to get involved in this debate or if you have any question. Heidi on Facebook says, GMOs should be labeled, whether they are harmful or not. People should have the right to know what they're putting in their bodies and avoid what they want for whatever reason. And if I read correctly, Nathaniel, you think labeling would be a good idea?
I do. You know, one of the things that we haven't talked about is that a lot of changing the genetics of plants, doing genetic engineering on plants, is just one of a lot of things that we've done with our food supply in modernizing agriculture. It's sort of the thing that we've fixed upon, but there are actually other forms of breeding plants, which are objectively riskier than genetic engineering, that we don't worry about. You know, we don't say we have a right to know if this plant has undergone mutagenesis or if it's in a factory that, a farm that used antibiotics routinely. So, I mean, there is argument that, you know, there's a million things perhaps that we should label, but I think that this argument has just gotten so heated that we need to do something about it. And labeling genetically modified foods would be a real pressure release and would allow the people who are really worried about it to avoid those foods allow the debate to simmer down a bit.
Yeah, the food makers are really going to object to that, though, aren't they? Because they think it scares people away from their product for no scientifically sound reason.
That's right. They've objected strenuously in the form of giving millions upon millions of dollars to support advertisements in states that have proposed labeling in general elections. So California and Washington State have both put labeling measures on the ballot, and were basically defeated by this advertising campaign from the seed companies and the food manufacturers. So yes, they do object strenuously, but at this point they're starting to warm toward labeling in some form, probably a voluntary form, as you see from this Cheerios announcement.
Mm-hmm. Now, help me out in understanding what happened in Hawaii. Didn't the entire state of Hawaii want to ban GMOs?
The it's an island by island thing. So so Kauai decided that it would really restrict farming practices that involved genetically modified crops, and they'd ask for a lot more information about what pesticides were being used, et cetera, et cetera. And the island of Hawaii, the big island, the council did just pass a ban on genetically modified foods, crops.
Yeah. Well, this this debate isn't going away anytime soon, is it?
Unfortunately, not. I'm afraid not. You know, it's interesting how little impact the discussion of it or new information seems to have on the debate itself or the way that people react to these issues.
Pat in Richland Center is with us. Hello, Pat.
Well, welcome back, Joy.
Thank you.
And, right now I listen to our local radio station, and the ag companies are really, really at full blast selling their seeds and herbicides, pesticides, and stuff to the farmers. And also there's always a news show about agriculture that I listen to. And just a couple of days ago, the expert from one of the poison companies was telling farmers that there's some new weed out there. I can't remember the name of it. But farmers, I know it's going to cost more, but we got to go back to our applications we were using 20 years ago. That means doubling the poison, the herbicide we've been putting down. I know it's more expensive, but we got to do it. So we got an arms race going on here, and you know, it just, I live out here. This poison, they put it on by the semi-load. Mm-hmm. And so...
Well, help us understand that again. We touched on it earlier, Nathaniel. Are we going to be using more or less poison if we were having more GMO crops?
Well, we're certainly apart from GMO crops, we're certainly using more herbicide all the time. He's absolutely right that it is an arms race. You know, the weeds evolve resistance to the herbicides, and the farmers use different types of herbicides and herbicides in combination with each other. And it's just been going up and up and up, whether you look at GMOs or non-GMO practices. What the GMOs, the herbicide tolerant GMOs have allowed farmers to do is apply herbicides when the plants are up, and this has led to some very specific increases in Roundup so far. It looks like another herbicide tolerant plant is going to get approved for another herbicide, which would allow that to be applied as well. So that's you see this, you know, the arms race moving along with more herbicides, more herbicide tolerant crops to combat that evolution.
Mark in Oconomowoc is with us. Hello, Mark.
Hi.
I'm sorry, Mark. We lost you. Mark, we touched on it, but again, it's sort of this confusing thing. We're going to use perhaps more herbicides with genetically modified crops, but he was saying, are we going to end up having pests that are resistant to chemicals, and are things going to get worse with that?
Well, we already have some pests that are resistant to insecticides. There's a few different worms that can eat the BT corn and BT soy and aren't bothered by the that internal pesticide in that plant. The trick is that, you know, you can combat this if you're careful, because that these weeds and these pests are always evolving. And if you make sure that you have some different types of farming practices, then you'll have different types of evolution. So you'll have some worms that eat the corn that doesn't have the herb, the BT toxin in it, and will reproduce and create non-resistant offspring. And if you have enough of that, if you have enough of these refuges or farms that don't use this stuff, then that will intermix with the resistant ones and will prevent this from becoming too much of a problem. And that's a thing that's possible to sustain. It's not like you let the genie out of the bottle. You know, if you do this very carefully, you know, the entomologists tell me that's something you can sustain for decades on end. I think weed resistance seems to be a bit more problematic. We do just see this steady increase in herbicide resistant weeds and a big increase in the amount of herbicides that are put on fields. Now they're doing a better job about using the less toxic ones, but we still see an increase.
Laura in Madison is with us now. Hello, Laura.
Yeah, I wanted to reiterate a point that was made earlier about hybrids. We've been using hybrid seeds for almost a century now, and farmers wouldn't buy them if they didn't have superior traits. They pay more for hybrid seeds, and they do it for a reason. The other thing I wanted to mention is there are a lot of other GMOs that aren't being talked about here, things like insulin and human growth factor and hepatitis vaccines that we wouldn't have in the abundance that we do today if we weren't using genetically modified organisms.
Mm-hmm. That part of the debate, Nathaniel?
Yeah, I think, I mean, all of that is true. You know, the hybrid seeds are, seeds that seed companies have improved and that are not genetically modified. They are often patented, and they're often left out of this debate. In terms of genetically modified medical advances, yes, we see a lot of interesting things coming out of the medical field. And that's an area where the debate is much more, much cooler. I think it gets back to this issue of GMOs being symbolic of something bigger. You know, when we're not talking about who's in control of the food system, and instead we're talking about, something that you'd get after careful consultation with a doctor, and something that you're making a conscious decision could really improve your health. People are a lot more willing to accept that.
Yeah. So how can we come toward a compromise or a resolution of all the different arguments in the GMO debate?
Well, I think the first step is to try and unravel some of the things that we've attached to the genetically modified organism debate. I think there are really important discussions that we need to have about the way that we're growing food and who's in control of it, these issues of the fact that we're continually putting more herbicides on our fields. But these things aren't directly related to genetically modified foods. You know, you take genetically modified foods away, and we still have all of these problems. And I think if we can realize that, it might help us refresh the debate a bit and focus in on what really matters, because the debate has just gotten so airless and stale and just the same arguments and cliches repeated over and over again that it's hard to make any real headway.
We'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for talking with our listeners about this.
It's my pleasure. I appreciate it.
Nathaniel Johnson, journalist, food writer for Grist, a teacher at the University of California, Berkeley, Graduate School of Journalism, the author of a recent series of articles about GMOs for Grist, including What I Learned from 6 Months of GMO Research. None of it matters. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Bill Martins for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Tomorrow at this time, it's Friday, so that means it's the Week in Review. We'll talk with two guests from different political perspectives about the news of the week. That's tomorrow between 8 and 9. We're also going to go ice fishing tomorrow morning after 6 o'clock, and we're going to talk about the rise and fall and rise again of beards after 7. So interesting conversations coming up tomorrow here on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.